I think we can start. Welcome, everybody. It's nice to see everybody, and we look forward to learning more about the Haftorah. That we look forward to learning with you, and as we continue. Okay, Vakasha.
Thank you. Okay, so the Haftarah for the Sidra of Vayera is from Nevi'im Rishonim. Be perfectly candid, I have never done the statistics. My impression, that's born of anecdotal experience, is that the book of Tanakh, or the book of Nevi'im, from which the most Haftarot are drawn, is the book of Yeshayahu. And I would dare say that more Haftarot come from Nevi'im Acharonim than come from Nevi'im Rishonim. Okay? This week's Haftarah is one of the minority that come from the so-called early prophets. Hard really to tell why they were called early prophets and the others were called late prophets. It's true that Samuel was certainly one of the first prophets we know of by name, but considering that the books of Kings are part of Nevi'im Rishonim, they go all the way through until the destruction of the first temple. So basically, the book of Malachim outlives pretty much nearly all of the Nevi'im. In fact, the term Nevi'im Acharonim, so far as I know, is late, meaning I don't think it's Talmudic or Midrashic, while the term Nevi'im Rishonim is. There is actually a phrase that appears in Talmudic literature. It actually describes what is called the Evan HaShetiyah. I leave that untranslated for the moment because that may yet be a subject for discussion. It's that which is generally known as the foundation stone on which at least the Beit HaMikdash, the temple, is said to rest. And it's described as Evan Haitasha Mimot Nevi'im Rishonim, which is a very unusual phrase if you think about it. It says there was a stone there in Jerusalem from the days of the earliest prophets. Now, generally, stones are there from the time that they were created. So it's very strange to have this phrase describing that foundation stone or whatever kind of a stone it was as something that was not there from creation, but was only there from the time of the earliest prophets, which may very well be a suggestion that it didn't originate there, for which there are two explanations. One is that it was the original rolling stone. Okay, that's a joke. And the other is that it was a meteor. And perhaps it was part of the collective memory that that meteor fell to earth during the time of the Nevi'im Rishonim. In any event, the Haftarah for the Sidra of Vayera comes from the fourth chapter of the second book of Kings, Malachim Bet Perek Dalet, and it features the prophet Elisha. And I guess with that, we can go straight to the screen. Okay. The chapter itself is much longer than the requirement. You may recall over the last couple of weeks, we've referred back to the laws of the Haftarah that dictate that a Haftarah has to be at least as long as the shortest Torah reading. And since the Torah reading consists of a minimum of three verses times seven people who are called to read, it would make the minimum Torah reading 21 verses, and therefore the minimal size of a Haftarah is also indicated to be 21 verses. This one is actually 37 verses in length, So clearly one of the questions that we will address is, do we really need all of those 37 verses in order to fulfill the obligation of a haftarah? Meaning, are all 37 verses visibly connected to this week's Torah reading? Or is it possible that there are some verses that are there, not necessarily because they link to the Torah reading, but maybe because they link to the balance of the haftarah, and that somehow the haftarah would not be a literary whole without them? Here we have the text. And the first seven verses are exactly that part of the haftarah that does not at the outset seem to bear any relationship to the accompanying Torah reading. It's a story of how a certain woman who was the widow of somebody who was a PIT, prophet in training. Okay, the Hebrew term is B'nai HaNivim, but B'nai HaNivim are not the people whose parents were prophets. B'nai HaNivim is understood as people who are studying to be prophets, which in itself is a curious kind of an avocation, since generally, or at least the consensus of medieval Jewish philosophers, is that one cannot become a prophet simply by training for it. The only medieval Jewish philosopher who comes close to it is Maimonides. Maimonides speaks about prophecy as being the perfection of one's intellective abilities. But even Maimonides acknowledges that a person could theoretically have the most perfect intellect and yet not be a prophet unless God granted him prophecy. Okay, so just who these B'nai Nevi'im were is really difficult to tell. They appear here, they appear in just a couple of other places, again, mostly in the Nevi'im Rishonim, and really not enough information to make a clear identification. In any event, the widow of one of these B'nai Nevi'im, one of these prophets in training, approaches the prophet Elisha and shares with him a problem that she has. Okay, he says to her, and I've highlighted it in yellow there, ma'e'eselach, and if I've highlighted it, then it's an indication that there's going to be something close to it later on in the haftarah, and that I'm underlining it here as perhaps a suggestion that this is what links this possibly unnecessary part of the haftarah to the balance of it. Okay, he says to her, ma'eselach, what can I do for you? And she says, problem is that I've got nothing with which to feed my family. In fact, the only thing that I have in my house is a pot of oil. And he tells her to go out and to borrow empty vessels from all of her neighbors. And at the end of verse 3, he adds two words. He says, al tam'iti, don't be stingy, meaning borrow as many empty vessels as you can. Okay? And then he gives her instructions. And the instructions in verse 4 are to come into her house, v'sagart hadelet ba'adech uva'ad banayech, and to close the door behind her, enclosing herself and her sons in the house. And then she is to pour the oil from the vessel that she had into all of the empty vessels. And she follows his instructions, v'tisgor hagelet ba'ada uva'ad baneha, and she closes the door, sealing herself and her children inside the house. And they would hand the empty vessels to her, and she would pour into them from that small cruse of oil that she already had. And at one point in the process of filling, she turned to her son and she said, next, right? And the son says to her, there is no next. And instantly, end of verse 6, Vayamod Hashamen, the oil stopped flowing. Okay. So she comes and she tells the prophet, as though he didn't know what was going to happen. But in any event, she comes and she tells the prophet what happened. And he tells her to go and to sell the oil. And with the money that she would get from selling the oil, she would pay the debt that was outstanding, her husband's debt that she was unable to pay. And he even tells her that there will be enough money left over to sustain her and her children. Okay. And that's the end of this episode. This is a short story, as opposed to the balance of the Haftarah, which is somewhat more of a novel. Not that it is so much longer. I told you, after all, that it's all of 37 verses, so it's 7 verses here and 30 verses for the balance. Okay, but in the sense that this is a reasonably, literarily controlled situation. It really involves only two characters, the widow and the prophet. There's really a minimum of activity. All of the activity really consists of pouring oil into vessels. Okay? The purpose of the story, not so much as our Haftarah is concerned, but the purpose of the story as it is told within the Book of Kings is to impress us with the capacity of the prophet to do things that are extraordinary. You may remember that Elisha was himself the disciple of the prophet Elijah, of Eliyahu Hanavi. And we are told several anecdotes about the miraculous powers of Eliyahu Hanavi. So here, the purpose of the story could be to assure us that Elisha was indeed a true inheritor of his master's mantle. Okay. And therefore, he too is possessed of this uncanny ability to help people. Now, of course, as I said, the point is that he uses these powers, if we wish, for good. Meaning, it's in order to support a widow. The Torah tells us on numerous occasions to be helpful and charitable to widows in particular. So she's a widow. Secondly, she's the widow of someone who was an aspiring prophet. Okay, so he uses his abilities to help her. Okay, that's good. Now we move on to the next episode. And since it is a next episode, a new episode, it has its own introduction, its own equivalent of once upon a time. And the equivalent of once upon a time, you see highlighted in verse 8 in Pasuk Chet, Vayihi Hayom, which, right, if not quite literally, means once upon a time, right? The day came to pass when Elisha passed through the town of Shunem, where there was an important woman who somehow forced him or impressed upon him to join her for a meal. And so it came to pass that every time he went through the village of Shunem, he would stop at the home of this woman to eat. Okay, so he is now the recipient of somebody else's kindness, and therefore it's entirely in character for him to return the favor. So he says to the woman in verse 9, the woman says to her husband, I know that the man who passes by and whom we feed is an Ish Elohim Kadosh, that he is a man of God, a holy man of God. Na'asena aliyat kir ktana, let's set aside room for him in our attic, and there we will give him a bed and a table and a chair and a lamp. V'hayabavo o'eleinu, and every time he passes through town, yasur shama. Not only will we feed him, but we'll give him a place to sleep as well. Okay. So, once again, Vayihi Hayom, so once upon a time, we now have the background, okay? So on one of those subsequent occasions that Elisha was passing through the town of Shunem, Vayavo Shama, he arrived at the house of this woman. Vayasar El Ha'aliyah Vayishkav Shama, he took advantage of their hospitality and he used their accommodations. And he felt obliged to them for it. So he said to his servant Gehazi, summon this Shunammite woman. And she comes and she presents herself before him. And he says to her in verse 13, Hine charadit eleinu et kol hacharada hazot. Literally, you have trembled all of this trembling on our account, which is probably a highfalutin way of saying you have gone to all of these lengths on my behalf. Okay. Ma la'asot lach, what can I do for you in return? Hayesh l'daber lach el ha-melech o el sar ha-tzava? Maybe you need somebody to intercede on your behalf with the king. Right? Maybe the king wants something from you and I can put in a good word. Or maybe one of your children is eligible for the draft and maybe I can put in a good word with the army on his behalf. And she declines. She declines his offer with a very interesting phrase. It's one that is used very often in subsequent Hebrew literature as an expression of humility. Betoch ami anochi yoshavet. Literally, I dwell amongst my own people. Or in other words, I'm nobody special. Right? I'm not deserving of your doing anything on my behalf. Right? I don't feel that I am entitled to it only because I have made accommodations for you. Okay. But Elisha is not satisfied. He still feels this obligation. So he turns to his servant and he says to his servant, Mala Asotla, what do you think we can do on her behalf? And his servant answers, Aval Bein Ein La V'Isha Zaken. She is childless and her husband is old. Okay, first of all, let's ring the bell and say that we have found our link to this week's Torah reading. Clearly, whoever set up the haftarot was looking for something that paralleled the story of the tidings that were given to Abraham and Sarah about the impending birth of Isaac. And just as Abraham describes himself as an old man who is long past the point at which he thought of himself capable of fathering a child, so it is that the husband of the Shunammite woman is described as a zaken, as someone who is elderly, and again, past the point at which he would expect to father a child. Unlike Sarah, whose age we know at that moment in time was 90, we do not know the age of the Shunammite woman, but we can assume that if her husband was elderly, then she was probably elderly as well. A second point to make here is that this is not the first time that the prophet Elisha is passing through the town of Shunem. It may be the first time that he's using the accommodations that were provided for him, but it's certainly not the first time that he joined the family for a meal. And yet, in spite of the fact that he has had prior acquaintance with the family, it would seem that he didn't know that the couple that the couple was childless, and that he needed this secretary, right, Gehazi, simply to apprise him of something that you would expect him to know. So perhaps he was really an Ish Elohim in the sense that his head was always in the clouds, right? And even when he sat down to the table to eat, he probably couldn't even tell you what was on the menu. And therefore, it probably just simply was not something that he was aware of. Okay. So, in the next verse, he tells Gehazi to summon the woman, and she comes and she stands at the entrance to his room. And he says to her in verse 16, "Lamoed hazeh ka'et chaya," at this time, or on this day of the calendar, in the next year of your life, "at choveket bein," you will be able to embrace a child. Not clear whether Bain here is a child or whether Bain specifically is a son. We know from the continuation of the story that it turns out to be a son. Okay, but whether Elisha was making her a general promise that she would bear a child, or whether he was making her a very specific promise that it would be a son, nowhere really to tell just from the small amount of text that's devoted to it. And here too, her reaction is reminiscent of something that was reported in this week's Torah reading. She says to him, and it's underlined in red, "Al techazev b'shivchatecha." Now, it's not quite saying, "Don't lie to me," because the ordinary Hebrew word for a lie is sheker. She doesn't say to him, "Al teshaker," don't tell a lie. She uses the word kazav, which is more like to prevaricate, meaning she's saying to him, "Don't put me on, right? Don't pull my leg. This is not a joking matter," okay? And you see underlined in red a few lines below it, the similar reaction that's reported apropos of Abraham receiving the news that Sarah would bear a child. "Vatitzchak Sarah bekirba lemor," Sarah too took this as a matter of jest, saying, "Acharev loti haita li edna," am I once again going to become pregnant? "Vadoni zaken," it's not going to happen. Okay. And yet, verse 17, "Vatar haisha," she conceives, "Vateled bein," and she bore a child, and guess what? It was Lamoed hazeh ka'et chaya asher diber eleha Elisha. Whatever the sequence of time was that Elisha promised her, whether he's saying on this day in a year or whether he was saying 9 months to the day, can't tell with that degree of specificity, but whatever it was that he promised to her, it came to pass. And she bore a child exactly as it was foretold by the prophet. Now, if at this point in time we had 21 verses, then maybe the Haftarah would end here. Because the only direct link that it has to this week's Sidra is, as I said, the tidings of the birth of a child under unexpected circumstances, and the reception that the news got, and the fact that in spite of the fact that it wasn't taken seriously at the outset, it nevertheless came to pass. But we continue. But before we continue, a word about births in unexpected circumstances. So here I made a quick list of women and children, where the births of these children were under unexpected circumstances. Not all the unexpected circumstances were identical, but they were alike in that they were all unexpected. So we have here the first instance of Sarah bearing Isaac, and the unexpected circumstance there was due to her advanced age. Later on in Sefer Bereshit, we're told about the births of both Joseph and then Benjamin to Rachel. Rachel was not particularly old, but Rachel was described as an akara, meaning that in contrast to her sister Leah, who was fertile, she was considered infertile, and therefore the births of Joseph and Benjamin, while not necessarily miraculous, right, nevertheless, I think it qualifies as a birth under unexpected circumstances. The next one we hear about is the birth of Moses to Yocheved. Now, we know again nothing about Yocheved, other than she's clearly not infertile, because Moses is really the youngest of her three children. She's already born, right? Miriam and Aaron, okay? But the whole context there, because of the edict of Pharaoh and the casting of all newborn Jewish infants into the river, again, the birth of Moses is unexpected. Again, maybe not miraculous, but certainly a birth under unexpected or unusual circumstances, right? Hannah is described as an akara until she bears Samuel. Mrs. Manoach, we don't know her name, we just know that she's, well, her husband's name was Manoach, right? She gives birth to Samson, to Shimshon, right? And there the tidings were brought by an angel. That alone qualifies as an unexpected circumstance. Here we have our own story about the birth of a son to the woman of Shunem. And only because I thought that if I didn't put it in there, somebody might say I missed it, I put in the birth of Emmanuel to the young woman of Isaiah 7:14. The famous verse, Hine ha'alma hara v'yalada vein, that a young woman will conceive and give birth to a child, the one, of course, that was taken by Christians in a very faulty translation to be not just a young woman, but particularly a virgin. Okay, and then you can see this one that I blacked out. I thought it worked well last week, so I try it again now. The one that I blacked out is the one that is described in the text below it, okay? Of this person, it is said, my high priestess mother conceived me. In secret, she bore me. She set me in a basket of rushes. With bitumen, she sealed my lid. She cast me into the river, which rose over me. Who's that? Now, you're probably thinking, wait a second. It's clearly Moses, right? Moses' mother bore him in secret, and then when she could no longer keep him at home, she put him in a basket of rushes, she sealed it with bitumen, she placed it in the river, right? It's all there, except that I already have Moses down on the list. Now, would I be so crass as to try to trick you by putting Moses in twice? Certainly not. So in spite of the fact that this looks every bit like Moses, it isn't. And here's the interesting part, as soon as I get rid of this and tell you what it is. So let me first get rid of the rest of the text here. Okay. The river bore me up and carried me to Aki, the drawer of water. Aki, the drawer of water, took me as his son and reared me. Now, if it said the river bore me up and carried me to Bithia, you'll remember her, right? Bithia from the Ten Commandments. That's the name that they gave to Pharaoh's daughter, right? So if it said that the river carried me to Bithia and Bithia took me as her son and reared me, then truly it would be Moses, okay? But this is not Moses. In fact, it's very interesting who it really is. It's Sargon of Akkad, the Assyrian king. Now, not surprising that the Egyptians, the Mesopotamians, whether they were Babylonians, Assyrians, Akkadians, doesn't matter, right? Regarded their kings as divine, okay? But that there was a Mesopotamian myth independent of the Bible that told the story of how someone who became a king in Mesopotamia was born to his mother in secret and then placed in a basket of rushes and put into the river from which he was rescued. That's rather remarkable. So if you ever come across studies on biblical literature a reference to the Sargon myth, then you should know that that's considered to be the archetypical myth of a miraculous birth or a birth under unusual or extraordinary circumstances. Okay. But we're not done with Elisha and with the child. Okay. The child now grows up. Okay. We don't know to what age, but once again, we find, you see the yellow underlining, we're in a new, you know, a new part of the legend, a new part of the story, a new chapter, or if you wish, a new scene, okay? Vayi hayom, once upon a time, vayetzel aviv el hakotzerim, that he went out into the fields to join his father in the harvest. Now that tells us something. It tells us that it took place in the summer, because that's when the harvest takes place. An ordinary harvest, if nothing is more specified, is probably the wheat harvest. And the wheat harvest does take place in the summer, okay? And at one point, Vayomer El Aviv, he turns to his father and he says, Roshi, Roshi, right? I've got a headache, okay? So the father turns to one of his workers and he says, take him home. Take him back to his mother. So the worker picks him up and carries him home and delivers him to his mother. And he sits on his mother's lap. That gives us some indication of his age, right? Again, can't tell you whether he was 5 years old or 9 years old, but it's somewhat reasonable that he wasn't a teenager, okay? Adat Soharayim, right? For an undisclosed length of time, Vayamot, and he dies. Okay. What does she do now? She takes the child, okay, and she brings him up, Vata'al. Remember that the room that they had assigned to Elisha was an attic room. So she had to take him, literally Vata'al, she had to take him upstairs. And she lay him down on the bed of the holy man. And now you see why I had this phrase underlined three times in the story of the cruise of oil, because that may very well be what links that episode to this one. Vatisgor ba'ado vateitze, the closing of the door, the sealing off of the prophet's room. And she summoned her husband, and she says to her husband, get me one of the workers and one of the donkeys. I've got to make a quick trip to the man of God, and I'll be right back. And her husband is not quite suspicious, but he's curious. So he says to her, Matua at holechet elav hayom. Why are you making a trip to see him today? And notice the underlining, lo chodesh velo shabbat. It's neither the new moon, neither the first of the month, nor is it Shabbat. Implication is that if she had come to him on either Rosh Chodesh or on Shabbat and said, I want to make a trip to see the man of God, her husband would have said, well, of course, you do it every, Rosh Chodesh. Okay? If you do it every Shabbat, sure. But since it was neither Rosh Chodesh nor Shabbat, okay, which tells us that it must have been customary in those days for people to make visits to holy men on exceptional days of the calendar. Now, that there is a particular association between women and Rosh Chodesh is something we know, again, not so much from the Bible, but we know from later rabbinic literature. Rosh Chodesh was kind of like a federal holiday for women, so to speak. Not that they ever got off work. It's not that they were relieved for a day of their chores around the house. But it was considered a day of celebration for them. Okay. So it would seem that for women to make trips to see prophets, or maybe to the Mishkan in the days of the Mishkan, right, on Rosh Chodesh or on Shabbat was customary. I got to stop for a moment for a parenthetical observation, and then has somewhat more serious implications. She told her husband that to make the trip, she needs a donkey. And her husband looks at her and says, why do you want to make a donkey ride today? It's not Shabbat. The implication very clearly is that there was nothing amiss with taking a donkey ride on Shabbat. And indeed, the Talmud in Masechet Shabbat tells us that in fact, the prohibition against riding an animal on Shabbat is not, strictly speaking, a Torah prohibition. It's a rabbinic prohibition. And it was enacted not because the act of riding a donkey is in itself prohibited, but it was enacted in order to make sure that someone riding an animal on Shabbat would not inadvertently break off a branch from a tree in order to give his mount a whack, in order to keep it in line or in order to make it go faster. So indeed, this is pretty good evidence that riding a donkey per se during the time of the first temple was permissible. Okay. In any event, her response to her husband is shalom, which is pretty close to a non-answer. Okay. So much so that she ends up having to saddle the donkey herself. So she saddles up the donkey, and she tells her, the worker, right, not to get in her way, okay, just to simply accompany her. So she goes to the prophet, to Mount Carmel, and when the prophet sees her at a distance, he comments to his servant Gehazi, look, the Shunammite woman is coming. Why don't you run out to greet her, right? And ask her, Hashalom, is everything okay? Hashalom li'ishech, is your husband okay? Hashalom la'yeled, is your son okay? Again, if she had been coming to him on Rosh Chodesh or on Shabbat, he might not have sent Gehazi out to greet her. And he might not have instructed him to raise all of these questions because he would have understood that this was an ordinary trip. The fact that the trip was taking place on Tuesday, however, is apparently what prompted him to appreciate that this was a trip that was being made under other than ordinary circumstances, and that it probably bespoke some sort of problem. And yet, the woman does not reply to Gehazi. She tells Gehazi the same thing she told her husband when she didn't want to answer his question. She said to Gehazi, "Shalom." Okay. So she approaches the man of God, and she clasps his legs, and Gehazi steps forward as though to chase her away because it's unseemly. And the prophet rebukes him, and he says, "Leave her alone," because obviously she is distraught. Okay. And then the last underlined phrase, "Vashem ha'elim mimeni v'lo higidli." And yet, God has kept this secret from me, so I don't know what is causing her distress. This assumption that when God is going to do something meaningful and there's a prophet around, that God informs the prophet, is yet another link to this week's Sidra. As you can see in the passage underlined in red at the bottom of the page, when it comes to subsequent episode of the destruction of Sodom, God says, "Hamchase ani me Avraham asher ani oseh." It's a rhetorical question, right? Am I going to withhold this from Abraham? To which the answer is clearly no. God tells Abraham about the impending disaster that will befall the city of Sodom. So we see this here too with Elisha, that he was surprised that God had not informed him of the source of the woman's distress. Therefore, Elisha now intervenes personally, and she says to him, "Tell me, did I come to you and request a child? Did I not at that time say to you, 'Al techazev b'shivchatecha'? Don't kid around." Okay. So what does Elisha do? He instructs Gehazi to take his, Elisha's, staff in his hand and to place it on the face of the child. And he tells Gehazi that time is of the essence. Therefore, ki timtza'ish lo tevarechenu, don't stop along the way even to greet people. And if anybody along the way wants to stop you and greet you, lo ta'anenu, don't even reply, just make a beeline for the Shunammite's house. Okay. But the mother is somehow, maybe it's just a maternal instinct, maybe it's a bit of insight. Her closing words are, "Chai Hashem v'chei nafshecha im e'ezveka." She takes an oath that she's not going to leave this alone. Vayakom vayelech achareha. So they make their way together following Gehazi. Gehazi is on the express, right? And they're, so to speak, on the local. And Gehazi follows his instructions. He places the prophet's staff on the child's face, but to no avail. Ein kol, the child isn't speaking. Ein kashev, there's no response. Vayashov likrato, so he returns to the prophet. Vayaged lo limor, and he says, "I did my best." Lo hekitzanar, the child did not revive. Okay. Interesting question. If he followed the prophet's instructions and the prophet clearly thought that that was all that was required to revive the child, and then if the child was not revived nevertheless, then clearly the prophet made a mistake. And the prophet thought that he could somehow second Gehazi to perform this on his behalf. And then he appreciated that clearly it was only going to work for him. So Elisha comes to the house, and the child is still dead, lying on his bed. And once again, we get the closing of the door. So he closes the door so that only he and the child remain in the room. And here's the key, perhaps, to the whole story, Vayitpalel al Hashem. Maybe he thought that it was implicit in his instructions to Gehazi, that before Gehazi were to place the staff on the child's face, that he too should recite a prayer. And maybe if Gehazi had recited a prayer, maybe he would have been successful in reviving the child. I don't know. But it's clear that we're given to understand that it's not the personal ability of the prophet that was able to revive the child, but it was the fact that this was in response, this was God's response to his prayer. So then, having prayed, he gets onto the bed and he places his mouth on the child's mouth and his eyes on the child's eyes and his palms on the child's palms. And vayigahar alav, and he, as it were, stretched out, vayizorer hana'ar ad sheva pe'amim, and vayifkach hana'ar et einav, and the child's flesh warmed up, and he opened his eyes. And he summoned Gehazi, and he told Gehazi to summon the Shunammite woman. Now again, why didn't he just call the mother in himself? Why did he have Gehazi do it? Probably because all along he hasn't spoken to the woman directly. He's always used Gehazi as an interlocutor when speaking to the woman. And he tells her, Si'i v'nech, right? Here's your child restored. You can take him back. Vatavo, so she comes, vatipol al raglav, and she, again, falls at the prophet's feet, and she prostrates herself on the ground, and then she lifts up her child, and she leaves the room, and this is where the Haftarah ends. Now, part of the purpose, which we are told these little maisalach, right? If it were told about a Hasidish Rebbe, right, we'd call it a maisel, right? And if we really didn't believe it, then it would be a particular kind of a maisa. It would be a grandmotherly maisa, right? It would be a bubba maisa. But it's an ish Elohim, it's a prophet, but nevertheless, it's a legend, okay? And as I mentioned at the outset, part of the purpose for which these legends are shared with us to tell us that Elisha was truly a worthy disciple of his master Elijah. And indeed, just in summary of that point, when Elijah was about to part company from Elisha, he granted his disciple a wish. "Tell me," he asked Elisha, "what can I do for you before I am taken from you?" To which Elisha replied, "Let a double portion of your spirit, pishnayim beruchacha, pass on to me." And if we are not inclined to view this as an act of hubris, it most likely signified that Elisha regarded himself as being only half the man of God that Elijah was, and therefore he would need twice his master's spirit in order to accomplish just as much. And here in our story, we find Elisha reprising some of Elijah's activities. When we were first introduced to the prophet Elijah, he performed the miracle to provide food for a woman of the town of Tzarfat. Tzarfat is not France here. Tzarfat is a Phoenician city. In the words of his prophetic message there, "The jar of flour shall not give out, the jug of oil shall not fail, until the day on which the Lord sends rain upon the ground." And here again in our chapter, we find Elisha miraculously providing sustenance for the widow of a prophet in training. And once again, there's a jar of oil involved. Even more striking, perhaps, is Elisha's duplication of Elijah's successful resuscitation of an apparently dead child. Elijah brought back to life the son of the woman of Tzarfat, after he had no breath left in him. The word vayamot is not used there as it is here. It simply says lo notra bo neshama. He wasn't breathing. And in our chapter, Elisha breathed life back into the son of the Shunammite woman, and the boy opened his eyes, vayivkach et einav. It's significant that in each of the two cases cited here, the prophet first uttered a prayer to God before actually performing artificial respiration. Indeed, the failure of Gehazi, Elisha's servant, to succeed in his attempt to revive the child would argue, as I mentioned just a moment ago, that more was involved here than just the exercise of CPR. In addition, towards the end of the chapter, we don't get it yet, but we don't have it here, but it's in the same chapter 4 of the second book of Kings, Elisha rescued a stew, a nazid, from poisonous gourds, probably poisonous mushrooms that had been mixed into it, by mixing in flour, that being reminiscent to an extent of Moses saving the bitter waters of Marah by tossing a branch into it, and then replicated his earlier miracle by enabling a small amount of food to feed 100 people. And when they had eaten, they even had some left over. Vayochlu, vayotiru kidvar Hashem. Arguably, a clear manifestation of his ability to enact a double portion, a pi shnayim, of the spirit of his master Eliyahu. That's it. That's the haftarah, and that's its link to the sidra. And let me take a quick look at the chat and see what we have here to respond. Somebody says that Evan Shtiyah means spinning. Yes, you look at the Hebrew word Shtiyah and it looks like, you know, imbibing, right? But there's no suggestion that the rock covers a spring or anything of that sort. Warp and woof in Hebrew are shti ve'erev. So indeed, the verb shin tav yod has something to do with weaving. And the rock, anybody who's ever crocheted, which obviously doesn't include me, but I've watched, okay? Anybody who's ever crocheted knows that when you start, right? You take the two needles, you bring them together, and you have like one little box, okay? And then everything else, no matter what you make, whether it's a pot holder or whether it's a quilt or whether it's a rug, right? Ultimately, everything comes from that first little stitch, so to speak. So the Evan HaShtiyah, if it means that the spinning in the sense of tied to the process of weaving, right, means that this is the point from which everything else in the world came into existence. That's an idea that's found in classical literature as well. There they don't use the image of the spinning wheel. They use the image of the umbilicus. Okay. All right. Okay. Yes, that prophets in training were called the sons of prophets is quite similar to the fact that the mitzvah of Jewish education, the idea that not only that parents are obligated not only to educate their own children, but that people who have the capacity to do so are obliged to educate children whose parents are not educating them, is derived from the verse Vishinam Tam Levanecha, right? To teach words of Torah to your children. So that children are not just biological children, children are spiritual children as well. Strange use of Anochi If you look at the sources, you'll see that I highlighted in red on the very first page several words for which there is a crayon ktiv. They're written one way but read differently. And in each of the cases, the form of the word that we don't use, the written form, has an extra yud in it. To the best of my recollection, the consensus of biblical scholarship is that this reflects an idiom of the northern kingdom. It's an indication that the origin of this story, and it's not surprising because that's where Shunem is situated, that's where Elijah was, that's where Mount Carmel is situated, that these stories originated in the northern kingdom, and that this was a literary or linguistic link to that northern kingdom. Okay. Okay. Yeah, somebody guessed that it wasn't Moses because Moses' mother was not a high priestess. She was better than that. She was the mother of the high priest. Okay. Idea of closing the door connected to Yetziat Mitzrayim. There the door was closed. First of all, I'm not sure the door was closed. I'm not even sure they had doors. The only thing that I know about Yetziat Mitzrayim is they had a doorway, because they were instructed to place the blood on the doorposts and on the lintel, which has always been a problem in my mind, because if the idea is to create some sort of a sacred barrier, right, and it was meant to keep the plague out, right, then why wasn't the threshold covered? So maybe when we get to the Sidra of Bo, I'll share my answer with you to that question. Okay, closing the door also connects to Lot in Sodom and to Noah in the Ark. Noah didn't close his own door. God had to close it for him. I kind of think of it like when you get on a plane, right? You notice always that the door closes first by pulling it in and then pushing it out again, right? That's, I guess, because the plane has to be sealed airtight. I guess the ark had to be sealed airtight also. And therefore, before Noah could close the door by pushing it out, somebody had to push it in for him. I don't know. It's obviously not an answer that anybody could have given before the 20th century. So I'm sure that there must be plenty of pre-20th century answers to the same question. So that's pretty much it, I think. Anything else here? Okay. Jay, back to you.
Yeah, somebody asking another link to the Sedra, the revival from the dead, of Yitzchak.
I wondered whether anybody would mention that. With the time now only a minute before 9, I really can't share with you. I'd be glad if you want to set up something. I have my own take on the story of the Akedah. But yes, indeed. There's if whoever raised the point, if they're not acquainted with Shalom Spiegel's The Last Trial, then you certainly should make the acquaintance of it. Shalom Spiegel was in the third quarter of the 20th century, probably the world's leading authority on medieval Hebrew poetry. And he was impressed by the fact that this legend that Isaac's life was taken by Abraham at the Akedah seems to have originated in Germany, in Ashkenaz, at the time of the First Crusade. So basically the theme of the book is to trace it back to piyutim, to liturgical poems of the 11th and 12th century, and to make the argument that at a time that Jews were martyring themselves and martyring their families in order not to fall into the hands of the Crusaders, somebody got the idea, hey, maybe that's what happened to Isaac as well. And therefore, you get this theme that runs through liturgical poetry. We see it as well in the liturgical poems that we recite on the High Holy Days. This idea that somehow not only was Abraham prepared to sacrifice his son, but that somehow he actually did, and that God then had to resurrect Isaac. But that's really just the nutshell. Again, the source for it is in Shalom Spiegel's The Last Trial, but there is now a brand new book by Aaron Kohler, just published last month by the Jewish Publication Society. I don't remember the title, but it's all about Akedat Yitzchak in Jewish, Christian, and Muslim traditions. So if you're interested in that, there you've got a bibliography.
And the last issue of Tradition, which I just got in the mail the other day. I haven't read the review yet, but I've heard good things about the book. And Aaron Kohler will be giving our Parsha Shir in a couple of weeks. I don't remember which week, but he will be giving it soon. Tomorrow night, Wendy Amsalem will be giving our Parsha Shir at 8:30. It's a nice segue here. And then and tomorrow morning, 11 a.m., Shuli Mishkan will be giving the third of her series on archaeology in the land of Israel, archaeology and Tanakh in the land of Israel. So tomorrow, 11 and 8:30. Everybody be well. Thank you, Dr. Sokolov, for that. We look forward to seeing
you. Pleasure as always.
You next week, and we look forward to seeing everybody even sooner than next week, and invite your friends. And on behalf of Torah Moshe, I want to wish everybody Laila Tov, and maybe by the time we wake up in the morning, we'll know who's going to live on 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue. I think that's the address. No, is that okay?
That's the address.
It depends whose address, but okay. Anyways, everybody be well, and we look forward to learning with you and seeing you. Thank you. Bye.